Where I make wine, I like to push the limits of where grapes ripen.
People just need to trust their own palate and not be concerned about what a critic says or what they read in the paper.
As a master sommelier, I mean, for me, at this point in my life, I'm kind of more in the Yoda stage.
My dad used to say when I was a little kid that the best wine you'll ever have is one you want to have another glass of.
I had a moment when I realized the power of wine. One day at a dinner, a bottle of Mouton Rothschild 1955 was opened and it just like silenced the whole table.
I'm so happy when a friend of mine sells a bottle of wine. And I love to brag about the wines that are being made by our friends because I'm so proud of them.
Farming is agricultural warfare.
I can't imagine doing anything else.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle and welcome to podcast number 166.
And this week we feature sommelier Jane Lopes from the Esquire TV network show Uncorked. Jane Lopes is sommelier for 11 Madison Park, New York City, and is one of seven cast members of Esquire Network's television show, Uncorked. The show, similar to the documentary Somm, follows the experiences, successes, and failures of these Somms as they work toward their Master Sommelier exam. Uncorked premieres on the Esquire Network on November 10th. We caught up with Jane via telephone to chat about her background, her love for wine, and just how the heck she ended up on this TV show. Well, I'm here with Jane Lopes, and Jane is a sommelier, and she is also one of the stars of the TV show Uncorked, which is running on the Esquire Network, geez, in just a few days, as of November 10th, right?
Correct.
Great. So, this is this whole road getting into wine, so the first question is, of course, you know, were you a wine drinker when you were younger? Was there some particular moment you got really interested in wine beyond the average?
I started drinking wine when I studied abroad in Rome my junior year in college. And, you know, it was just kind of part of the lifestyle there. It was part of your meal. It was cheaper than drinking water. So kind of got into drinking wine as kind of a ritual, not necessarily knowing that much about it. But after I graduated college in 2007, I was planning to take a year off and apply to PhD programs, and I just needed a job. So I thought, you know, working in a wine shop would be fun. I saw a listing. I applied for the job, and I got it. And, you know, within the year, I decided not to send in my applications, and I wanted to stick with wine. So that's, you know, where I really kind of fell in love with the profession.
I think a lot of people, tell me if you'd agree with that, are sort of drawn to wine. It's almost like you don't have a choice in the matter, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of how I felt. And, you know, it's interesting because very few people, especially in America, are introduced to wine when they're young. So, you know, when you're graduating high school and deciding what to do, very, very few people are considering a wine in a career in wine. And so as a result, you get a lot of people who kind of found this profession through various ways and have interesting backgrounds. And so it's pretty fascinating.
You think it's fair to say if America was a little bit less uptight about some of the laws we have regarding alcohol, things would be a little less, you know, crazy when it comes to booze and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, you would think so. Who knows in actuality? But you know, I think there is kind of this mentality towards alcohol when you're young that it's off limits. And you know, as a result, I think people go off to college and they don't have supervision and they just go crazy. And, you know, they're drinking all kinds of crappy alcohol and way too much of it instead of kind of developing a very, you know, a more nuanced approach to appreciating what you're drinking and drinking it for the sake of yes, like how it makes you feel, but also kind of the intellectual appreciation of what has gone into it.
Sure, it's like a revelation when you have your first real glass of wine, when you're like, wow, this is, wow.
Yeah, it's you know, wine is pretty incredible in what it can express. And I think, you know, most sommeliers and people in the wine industry will attest to kind of those wines that they had early on in their career that they just were blown away by. They just didn't know, you know, anything could smell or taste like that.
Yeah, it truly is an amazing moment. Now, if I'm not mistaken, you're from Chicago originally, is that correct or no?
No, I'm from California originally. I went to college in Chicago, and I lived in Chicago for 7 years.
Okay, what part of California?
Just outside San Francisco, Marin County.
Oh, so how appropriate.
Yeah, I was actually born in Napa.
Out of here.
Yeah. I lived in Sonoma until I was about 3, and then my family moved to Marin. But I, you know, I didn't drink any wine growing up. I never visited wineries growing up. It wasn't until I lived in Italy and Chicago that I got into wine.
It didn't matter. It was already in your blood.
Yeah, I guess so.
What a great place to grow up. My gosh.
Yeah, it was. Definitely did not appreciate it enough as a teenager.
So just to kind of catch up to where you're at, you've passed the advanced exam for the Court of Master Sommeliers, correct?
Correct.
And you're on the show studying for your master, correct?
Correct. The show follows 6 of us in New York City, well, really 7, who are preparing for the Master Sommelier exam in 2015.
Okay. I counted 6. Where did the 7th come from?
The 7th is introduced in episode 2. Actually my boyfriend, who is also a sommelier and also takes the exam. So he wasn't one of the original characters, but very quickly became an important part of the show.
Wow. That's got to be interesting to have a boyfriend who's a sommelier.
Yeah. You know, I think it's such an important part of both of our lives that it's nice to have someone who understands it, who understands both kind of the lifestyle and the difficulties, and also who has the same passion. I don't know if I could date someone who didn't care about wine. It would be hard.
I can't even imagine.
It was nice going through the process with him, and you know, we were able to kind of support each other and push each other at the same time.
I don't want to get too personal, but I imagine this is a fair question. Did you meet over wine? Was that something common, or was it something completely different?
Yeah, we did meet over wine. We met when I first moved to New York in a tasting group. Just kind of one my a friend of mine I knew from previous introduced me to, and we, you know, kind of meet a lot of sommeliers from restaurants all over the city, and that's how we met.
Cool. Well, good for you. That's got to be.
Yeah.
Do you get into debates? I mean, is it that kind of a dynamic?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, I think for the most part, we see pretty eye to eye on wine. But, you know, yeah, we'll have like silly little debates about like, you know, there's no oak on this. Oh, it totally tastes oaky, whatever it is.
Right.
nothing serious.
No, but that's got to be fun. I mean, to me, you know, good, honest debate between a couple is a lot of fun. As long as it doesn't turn ugly, yes.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, according to what I've been reading about you, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, your favorite right at this particular moment, or has been for a little while, is dry Riesling.
Yeah, it's been a passion of mine for a number of years. I visited Germany and Alsace and Austria. Well, Austria was earlier, but Germany. I did a trip to Germany and Alsace in late summer of 2013, right after I passed my advanced. You know, I kind of chose the region because I love the wine so much, and then really kind of cemented my passion for those wines, and was able to visit a number of really important, great producers. I just absolutely love the wines. I love kind of the nuances and balance you get from like dry Riesling with 3 grams of residual sugar versus dry Riesling with 9 grams, and how you can kind of see that balance change and the different vineyard sites and the different production methods, and you know, lee string versus neutral barrel, and like all of that stuff is really fascinating to me. And I feel like the nuances are to me, like really really clear and dynamic and interesting.
You know, I'm a fan of dry Riesling, though I wouldn't fall into your same category as being my favorite, but I sure like it a lot because seeking it out can be a lot of fun. But don't you think here in the States it's certainly high on the list of most misunderstood wines?
For sure, and I think that's probably one of the reasons it's so underpriced in a lot of instances. But, you know, I certainly, working on the floor of a restaurant, it's the minute you say the word Riesling, people are like, oh, I don't like sweet wine.
Yeah, right.
And it takes a lot to change that idea. And even, you know, even people's sense memory is really ingrained to think that Riesling is sweet. You know, you pour them a taste of Trimbach's Cuvée Frédéric Emile, which, you know, you can't get Riesling. I mean, you can't get really wine any drier than that. And you pour people a taste and they smell it and they just associate that smell with sweet wine. And even when they taste it, they're like, yeah, I guess it's not too sweet. You know, they still like almost trick their brain into thinking there's some residual sugar there. So there's a lot of bias against it. But I think, you know, when people start drinking it, especially with food, they realize how kind of incredible it is.
I'm just curious, since it is a favorite of yours, I'm obviously, as a sommelier, you have to have a certain level of objectivity. Do you find yourself, though, wanting to turn people onto it in the restaurant?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I think, you know, my goal in the restaurant is, though, not to, like, serve myself or a particular wine region, but always to serve the needs of the guests. So if someone comes in and they're asking for oaky, buttery Chardonnay, I'm not going to try to sell them dry Riesling.
That would be bad, yes.
Yeah. But if they're like, we want something dry and crisp that goes along with the food, what do you recommend? Yeah, sure. I'll be like, hey, have you ever had dry Riesling before? We have, you know, right now we have both dry Riesling from Alsace as well as from the Finger Lakes on our list. So it's, you know, it's fun to be able to turn people onto that.
How do you like the Finger Lakes?
I love the Finger Lakes. There's a lot of really great wine being made, especially Riesling. You know, and kind of great by any standards, not just like great for New York Riesling. Mm-hmm. There are a number of producers who are really doing a wonderful job, and the region is absolutely gorgeous. It's really fun to visit. It's such a great thing to have in New York and be able to tell people to visit and to sell the wines from. And it's, you know, I feel like it really adds a great dynamic to our restaurant.
You know, your role as a sommelier, I think this is a terribly challenging job. I mean, the restaurant business alone is challenging, speaking as an ex-waiter from a million years ago. But you're in a very kind of a hot spot job, wouldn't you say, in terms of, you know, how you would approach a guest? And you know, you have to do a little bit of mind reading, I would think.
Absolutely. And our, you know, our kind of service aesthetic is all about kind of having a nuanced psychological approach to the guest. And it's not about giving everyone the same cookie cutter experience. And I think that's especially pertinent when it comes to wine, because, you know, it's such a creative process, kind of engaging with someone and creating a wine experience that they're looking for. And, you know, some people want a glass of wine and maybe two and kind of, you know, don't really want to engage that much. And in that case, you kind of give people what they want. But a lot of people come to 11 Madison Park to have a very engaged experience. And even if those people only want to drink a glass or two, it's really important to be kind of present in their meal. So it's all kind of about reading the guests, you know, what they want, both in terms of what they want to drink, what they want in terms of wine and beverage, you know, including cocktails, beer, but also how they want to engage with us. But that's kind of what really keeps me interested, is having that kind of dynamic experience with guests every night.
Those of us who have different occupations in life, sometimes it's hard to sort of explain it to civilians, if you will, what you do for a living. Do you run into that sometimes? People are like, you're a what?
Sure. You know, I think that's kind of part of the beauty of having a little bit more of the spotlight on this profession is it's less and less I feel like I have to, you know, explain myself. And I certainly never, I think it used to be in the restaurant world that you would kind of get the question of like, oh, what do you actually want to do? you know, like this is just your side job until you get
you
through
up.
Med school or whatever, whatever else you're doing. And I think now it's much more understood that this is a career, it's a profession, whether you're working in wine or you're in the kitchen or you're a captain or a server in a restaurant, that you know, this is a profession in and of itself. So I think there is a lot more awareness now, but I think even sometimes when you say you're a sommelier, you know, you look at even the jobs of kind of the six of us on the show, and they're very different. Our job responsibilities, what we do on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, I think even kind of under the encompassing umbrella of a kind of a sommelier or wine professional, there's still, like, you know, a lot of things that people don't understand. But at the same time, like, tell me your job, or, you know, kind of someone in finance or whatever it is, and I don't necessarily understand what they're doing on a day-to-day basis either. So, you know, I think the awareness is there, at least kind of the respect, which is kind of all we need.
I think that is one of the biggest things, the respect, understanding the encyclopedic and beyond knowledge of a sommelier. It blows my mind as a wine lover.
Yeah, there's a ton to know. And it's almost like you'll never know it all. It's kind of like triage. You know as much as you can and what you need to know to execute your job or whatever certifications you're pursuing. But there's always more to know. Blind tasting is certainly one of the trickiest parts of the exam. And I think a lot of people are kind of who don't participate in the court or any sort of certifications are kind of like, what's the point? This is a party trick. But I can say honestly that it is tremendously helped my palate as a sommelier. And you'll see in the first episode, not to give too much away, but there's an exercise where they ask us in a competition setting to analyze three wines that are from the same region based on price. And, you know, I mean, how valuable is that? Like, if you're buying wines for a wine list and you're willing to put something on your list for $100, like, you need to be able to tell that quality from tasting it. And, you know, being able to analyze, like, you know, if I taste a Nebbiolo that's on my list and being able to describe it accurately to people to say, this is a super traditional Nebbiolo for this reason, or this is not a typical one for these reasons, to be able to taste that in a wine. So it's, you know, it's incredibly important to what we do to be able to pick qualities out of wines. As soon as you're able to do that, as soon as you're able to say, like, this wine is high tannin, high acid, falls in line appropriately with its age, it's not over mature, this is the fruit quality, there's volatile acidity, like, you know, all the things that you would do in a non-blind setting, it becomes very easy to apply those to a blind setting. So I think that's kind of all the test is. Like, yeah, you don't kind of, on a day-to-day basis in your job, need to be able to say exactly what a wine is blind, but you should be able to describe the qualities of it blind. And those should naturally lead you to know what it is.
Sure, I would think so. And that's what's fascinating about it to me. Do you consult on the side at all for independent buyers, that sort of thing?
I have in the past. Not as kind of a regular practice, but I've kind of been asked here and there to help out on wine lists, on cocktail lists. So it's something I just don't have, honestly, like, a ton of time to do it, especially when I'm studying.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like, yeah, it can be fun side projects sometimes.
I'll talk about the TV show for a minute or two here. Your life is fairly exposed on this show, I'm assuming. That's something you're comfortable with?
Not fully. You know, I think none of us went into the show wanting to be, like, because we wanted to be on television. It's hard. It was it's a very stressful process in general, and you add the stress of having people kind of follow you around and cameras in your face, and it's incredibly stressful. I mean, there's definitely, like, a lot of really vulnerable moments that are exposed. You know, you have kind of these moments in, like, competitions or exams that you're like, oh, that wasn't my finest, moment, but you're like, oh, but it's over, and, you know, but now it's kind of immortalized. But, you know, I think it's good because I think hopefully what it will do is kind of make everyone realize that, like, no one's perfect at this. Like, everyone's working. It's a constant process, and we all have our moments, and, you know, and people who are kind of pursuing these exams, I think it should kind of give some insight to the very, like, the very human side of it.
Sure. Yeah. You are human after all.
Yeah.
When you're on camera and you're tasting, I mean, I have to believe you have to totally put that camera out of your head, and maybe after a while you just get used to it.
Yeah, I think tasting may be actually kind of the easiest place to kind of ignore it, because you're just tasting always, like, just has to be about you and the wines. You're not even thinking about the people across the table from you scoring you. You have to be kind of dialed into the wines. Service is a little more difficult because you're interacting with people as it is. So, you know, it's much harder to ignore that you're kind of walking around cameras. There were kind of times where you, like, couldn't walk around the table the way you wanted to because
sure.
There was a camera in your way. And it's a little harder to ignore in that setting.
I imagine, too, there was a fair amount of sitting around and waiting.
I mean, honestly, they're fairly good about respecting our time. You know, there's always kind of times you wait in competitions and stuff, but I don't think too much was added by the TV show. They were very good.
Talk about your palate for a minute here. Do you do anything special to protect your palate? Are you careful about what you ingest normally? As a person who spends a great deal of time developing this sensitivity?
You know, it's not something I think about too often. I think I naturally avoid some of the things that people attest to hurting their palate. I'm not a coffee drinker. I don't smoke. I actually don't really, like, crave spicy food that much. So, like, you know, all these things that, like, could hurt your palate, I don't really kind of enjoy anyway. So it's not something I really think about too much. You know, I definitely think about when I'm going into a tasting, what I've had beforehand. Everyone has kind of their rituals. Some people like to, you know, have high acid wine before they go in. I always, like, my thing was always, I'd like to go into a tasting on an empty stomach. I thought it, like, being kind of slightly hungry made my senses a little more sharp. But, you know, I feel like I was about to pass out when I took my advanced exam, so I might have pushed that a little too far.
Oh, that's not good.
Yeah, exactly. Gotta toe that line. So, I mean, yeah, it's not something I think about too much. You know, I think our palates are probably a little more resilient than people think.
Yeah, I guess that's what it is. You sort of think of it as maybe a ballet dancer and their legs. On the other hand, you know, they're toned, they're trained. That's what it's all about.
Yeah. And they're not going to, like, mess them up by, like, sitting on them the wrong way, you know? You can't break your legs, but, you know, it's short of that, like, you're probably in pretty good shape.
So was it through the restaurant you get involved in the TV show, or was it, you know, I know that, according to what I've read, you've won the Wine and Spirits Best New Sommelier for 2014. Was that how that came about?
No. I mean, I don't think so. I actually wasn't working yet at 11 Madison Park when I was asked to participate in the TV show. So it was, they tried to get it going in 2014, from what I understand, and it just kind of didn't pick up momentum that year. And a friend of mine who's on the show, Josh Nadell, had been in talks with them in 2014. So when they were like, okay, we're doing this, it's happening, 2015, actually shooting it in 2015 for the 2015 exams, they were talking to him and they were asking him, you know, who should we contact, who should we reach out to, who would be a good addition to the show. They wanted to, you know, include a few women. And so, you know, I think they specifically asked him, like, what women should we reach out to? And he gave them my name.
Are you pleased that you went on the show? Was it a good decision for you?
Yeah. You know, I think at the time, maybe I would have said something different, but I kind of almost don't believe in regret. I know that sounds kind of hokey, but, like, it's what it is. I don't think it's going to be bad for me or my career. I think I would have asked, like, kind of what if I hadn't done it. And, you know, it's got me to, you know, part of my experience now. So, yeah, I don't regret it at all. I'm glad I did it. It was definitely an interesting process and kind of excited to see how it unfolds. And, you know, my boyfriend and I kind of talk about how it's kind of fun that we'll have this, like, record of our experience for this period.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, that's your part of your history is documented, this point in your life. Few people
totally
get that. Right. And best of all, you didn't have to hold up a camera. Somebody else did it.
Exactly. Yeah.
What kind of advice would you give to someone who is a novice or at least just simply a wine lover who would want to pursue this particular career?
I started out in retail, which I think was a really great opportunity to learn a lot. It's hard in a restaurant. You're constantly moving, and you know, in the wine shop, I had a fair amount of downtime to study and learn, and so that to me was like a really great first job. And it's also something that can kind of be a side job if people are making a transition from another profession. They can, you know, look into getting a part-time job at a wine store and getting involved in tastings. I mean, I think tasting as much as possible is really great, and there are always kind of tastings, usually at wine stores throughout a given city, that you are usually cheap, sometimes free, that you can go in and kind of taste a lot of wines. I would recommend getting a membership to the Guild of Sommeliers. It's really an invaluable resource. It's, I think, $100 a year, and it's just the kind of the information they have on there is crazy. You know, it's appellation laws on every appellation in the world, study guides on every region in the world. And then you also have kind of a community forum too, where people ask questions, people find tasting groups. And I think really it's in the last 5 to 10 years just become like, you can find a tasting group in any city in the country, I imagine. And it's a good way to kind of meet people who are like-minded. And I definitely would highly recommend, you know, pursuing exams through the Court of Master Sommeliers. Even if you just pass your intro or just pass your certified, the people you'll meet, the resources you'll be exposed to. For me, like, I completely base where I am in this community off the relationships I've built through the Court of Master Sommeliers and the knowledge and skills that I've gained as kind of using that as a framework. You know, no, kind of no matter what level someone gets to, it's really just being part of the process is really valuable.
Yeah, that's great. Do you know their website by chance?
Well, I guess there are two different things I was talking about. There was the court, which I think is Master Sommeliers US, something like that. And then Guild of Sommeliers, which is the educational resource, which is unaffiliated, but a lot of people who are pursuing those exams are using that as a resource, which is GuildSomm, GuildSomm.com.
Are you on Facebook, Jane? Any way somebody can learn about you?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, Jane, LOPES. I don't think there are too many of us, so I should be easy to find.
Hard to believe in the Facebook world.
Yeah, and Esquire TV has like an app and everything. It's very fully connected, so it's pretty easy to access.
Excellent. Well, there was one other thing I want to mention. Because of the production schedule and everything, and I'm sure there's things you can't talk about. Are you finished in production?
Yeah, production. Okay. For the TV show? Yeah, they're done.
Jane, I want to say thank you very much. I'm sure you're really busy studying your brains out, working a regular job, being on TV. I can't even imagine. So thanks for taking the time and giving us a call today.
Yeah, my pleasure. It was a lot of fun.
Learn more by visiting tv.esquire.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo.
Our host is Kay Paskoff. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2015.